That summer I went, after my first year there, I went to the General Assembly. And at the General Assembly, I think it was in Baltimore, if I remember correctly, and there was every delegate, as they came in, was handed a copy of a magazine called the Presbyterian Reporter or something. I forget what it was. But you open it up, and there was, that wasn't the name of it. I forget what it was. Dr. Wilson told me it was something that was widely distributed in western Pennsylvania. But this special assembly issue which they had, near the front of it, they had an article with a heading, "When the Professors Disagreed." And it said Dr. Robert Dick Wilson had spoken at Oxford in England, and that lecturer, what was his name, the official orator of the university, I forget his name now, he was away when Dr. Wilson did that. But he came back and heard about his talk. He said, they say he knows 30 different languages, but his knowledge of Latin is atrocious, because this article said mirabile dicta, and anybody who knew Latin would know it was mirabile dictu. Well, Dr. Wilson said that in his family, from his childhood, they had used these Latin words, mirabile dictu. And he gave the talk there at Oxford in which he used the phrase mirabile dictu. Somebody took it down, and from what they took after he left, it was printed in a paper there in Oxford. Did the mistake to dicta come in the original man who wrote it down, perhaps not being able to read his own writing, or in the printing, or what? But T.R. Glover, he was the orator of, or some such title of Oxford. He used that change of a letter to say that Wilson didn't know anything. It just showed the effort to destroy the standing of anyone who really stood for the Word of God. It's either that year or the next year when Dr. Machen was being considered for approval as professor apologetics at Princeton, that the assembly debated that, and I happened to see Henry Sloan Coffin. There's a later William Sloan Coffin, I imagine it's a nephew or something like this, but Henry Sloan Coffin had just become president of Union Seminary. And I happened to see him in the men from Union Seminary were working hard to keep Machen from being confirmed by the assembly as professor at Princeton Seminary, as full professor. And I said, "Dr. Coffin, when will your election as president of Union Seminary be considered by the General Assembly?" He says, "Union Seminary is not subject to any ecclesiastical domination." Well, as far as I can see, if an institution wants to take that attitude, perfectly all right. But why should they then come in and try to control who the assembly will approve for another institution? But that is. I remember at the assembly when they were considering Machen, and these people were attacking Machen publicly. Dr. Stevenson, president of the seminary, was tearing into Machen on the floor of the assembly. Mrs. Robert Dick Wilson was sitting in the gallery, and she told us later there was an elderly gentleman sitting near her who said under his breath, he says, "Serves Machen right. Serves Machen right." After the way he attacked dear Dr. Erdman, she says, "But Dr. So-and-so, didn't Dr. Erdman attack Dr. Machen first?" "Oh," he says, "we should forgive Dr. Erdman for that." She simply showed the difference in attitude. what those were days when.
Good afternoon. This is another oral history interview with Dr. McRae. The date is July 7th, 1989, and we're in the library office. We have two Korean students as guests, and Steve Haig and Dr. McRae and Mr. Pakula. Last time, Dr. McRae, you mentioned that you felt that Oswald T. Allis should be a full professor at Princeton, and the last Christmas you were a seminary student there, it would have been the Christmas of 1926. No, the Christmas of 27. Christmas of 1927. You went to the faculty committee chairman of the board and pastor of a big church in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Can I help you?
And this gentleman, whose name you couldn't exactly remember, now that would have been the board of directors, right? Because they were involved, of course, in faculty appointments. You said was more interested in your meeting his daughter than in particularly having Dr. Allis promoted. And no, that's quite all right. We like these anecdotes. And that this board member had minutes of the board of directors meeting on his coffee table or somewhere there. And that you happened to see while you were there an outstanding conservative, possibly at First Presbyterian in Cincinnati, and a noted liberal, whose name you couldn't quite recall either, but the conservative was a Dr. Stevenson? Okay, possibly a Dr. Stevenson. And both of these were nominees for the board of directors. And later you mentioned this was concern to Dr. Machen, and that everything, he said that everything he had, oh, that was, you mentioned that he felt everything he had learned from Dr. Armstrong, who you felt that you felt that was an overstatement.
I'm
sure. Definitely an overstatement. Although Dr. Armstrong was a poor teacher, he was quite a scholar and also vice president of a bank in Princeton and otherwise quite active. But in response to your mentioning this situation of seeing these minutes, Dr. Machen responded, "That's an internal matter of the board of directors, and the worst thing is that you should know anything about it. Of course, that would be suicidal if they'd elect a man like that." And then you mentioned that both at San Francisco Seminary and at Chicago Theological Seminary, you mentioned it was a Congregationalist seminary, that there were conservatives angry at modernistic teaching at these seminaries in those years, and each of these groups of conservatives got conservative professors who were incompetent.
Well, no, the thing is, they found that their Old Testament professors were liberals.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, they were simply taking the latest books that tore out the Old Testament to pieces and teaching what was in them. And their graduates objected. And so those men were fired. And then the seminaries, instead of finding good scholars who were strong conservatives, they simply got good preachers who were beloved personalities and brought them in and made them professors of Old Testament. And then these men, not being trained in the Old Testament particularly, they just got the latest critical books on the subject. So there was no improvement. And it contributed to both of those schools becoming rankly modernistic in the succeeding years. And of course, that's the big thing that impressed me when I was a student at Princeton, was that during the
previous 30 years, the liberals have been getting control of one theological seminary after another in this country. It was the natural result of their getting control of the big universities. And then getting control of the big universities, they got the fine Christian colleges. I think there were probably 100 back, say, in 1900, probably 100 fine Christian colleges in this country that stood for the Word of God and gave a very fine training to young people. And by 1930, it's my guess that there weren't more than 5 or 6 of them that had not become liberal. And the teaching that they give to the students then destroys their faith in the Bible.
Now, you mentioned these seminaries. What about Calvin Seminary, the Concordia Seminaries, all the Southern Baptist Seminaries? Certainly there were many more than 5 or 6. Are you speaking mainly of the mainline Protestant seminaries, the Presbyterian, Congregational?
No, I was speaking of the colleges.
Colleges.
Out of 100 fine Christian colleges in 1900, I doubt if by 1950 there would be as many as 6 that still stood for Christianity. That is, they would use a lot of Christian terminology. There was a woman I know of in New York who was the daughter of a very wealthy man, and someone got her to give some money to a college, I think it was in Virginia, which was supposed to be a fine Christian college, and she gave quite a large sum of money for their Bible department. And then 10 years later, she met a student who was there who told her how in their classes in Bible, they were simply tearing the Bible to pieces and making it a purely human book. And the result was that she was very much upset, and she went down there and tried to persuade them to give her money back. And they said, no, you've given the money to the college, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's ours now. It's not yours. Well, she didn't want her money given to training people in unbelief. So she was quite upset about it. And they said, well, they said, if you want, we'll be willing to transfer the money to the mathematics department instead of the Bible department. Well, she wasn't interested in the mathematics department, but she would a lot rather have her money training people in mathematics than training them in unbelief. And that was the way the colleges were going then, and most of the seminaries. And in 1920, there was, I was told that in 1920 there had been a motion in the General Assembly to form a big new church that would bring in all the churches together to work in that direction. And the thing was that many of these churches were out and out unbelieving in their confession. They'd given up their confessional statements altogether, and they really didn't believe in the Bible at all. And to the surprise of Dr. Wilson and Dr. Machen, they found that the president of Princeton Seminary favored that all getting together on that very broad general basis. And that was what opened their eyes to what was happening in the other seminaries. And, of course, their new president, whom they'd had for a few years at Princeton then, had not been a Princeton graduate originally, J. Ross Stevenson. And he was anxious to bring Princeton in line with the other seminaries, so there would be no difference between them. Now, Union Seminary of New York had been, during the 19th century, had been a great Christian seminary. It had wonderful teachers. But by the end of the seminary, they were teaching rank unbelief there. And about 1895...
With all this, I think we have in histories and
yes,
so on.
I just want to bring it out here as background.
Sure.
That Princeton Seminary's professors had attacked
Professor Briggs of Union Seminary, and he, as a result, he left the Presbyterian Church, and Union Seminary broke its relation to the church. Well, now we get to the end of my first year at seminary, and the man who was teaching apologetics, whose name I don't think of at the moment, but
William B. Green. He was
Brendy Green, they called him. William Brenton Green. He was a fine gentleman. I don't know how good a scholar he was. I never had any from him. But and I'm not even sure whether he died or retired at the end of that year. But it was necessary to get a new professor of apologetics. And at the end of my first year in seminary, the board of directors, the leaders of the directors thought, here's Dr. Machen, who has written that wonderful book, The Origin of Paul's Religion, and has written Christianity and Liberalism, and is universally recognized as a great scholar, and is thoroughly out and out for the gospel. Now, wouldn't Dr. Machen be a fine successor to Brenton Green to make him professor of apologetics? So they talked to Dr. Machen about it, and Dr. Machen was very hesitant because his primary interest was New Testament. Well, of course, apologetics would defend the New Testament against its attackers. And so they argued with him. He was interested in all the phases of the defense of Christianity, but for the other parts of it, he would have to do a great deal of special studying and work. And so they argued with him and finally persuaded him that he owed it to the cause to agree to accept the professorship of apologetics if they would elect him to it. And so they did that at the end, I believe, of my first year there, and he set to work studying into the field of apologetics during that year. And then at the end of the year, the board of directors elected him to be the professor of apologetics. And the next summer, that should be approved by the General Assembly, because the General Assembly from the beginning had always approved the professors of the seminary. Now, when Union Seminary refused to allow the General Assembly any authority over it anymore, they no longer had any approval for them, of course, but it was up to them to approve the professors in Princeton Seminary. And so, after my second year, the General Assembly met in Baltimore, and report of Princeton Seminary came up there, and the principal thing in it was electing Dr. Machen to be professor. Now, Dr. Henry Sloan Coffin had just become president of Union Seminary in New York, and when they were discussing Dr. Machen's election to the professorship, I happened to meet Dr. Coffin outside of the place the assembly was meeting, and I said, "Dr. Coffin, when is your election as president of Union Seminary to come up for confirmation?" He said to me, "Union Seminary is not subject to any ecclesiastical domination." And I told Dr. Machen about that, and Dr. Machen said that he thought that one of the most dastardly things in the whole situation was that these Union Seminary, after throwing off the authority of the General Assembly, that their people would come into the assembly and fight hard to prevent the Conservative Seminary from electing its men that it wanted to have. Well, I felt the same way, and especially when I saw what happened there, because when the matter came up on the floor of the General Assembly, President Stevenson, J. Ross Stevenson, the president of Princeton Seminary, who was trying to bring the seminary in line with all the other seminaries, although he would go out and give the most fundamental talk you ever heard in your life. Yes, one man told me he rang every bell. He talked just as straight as could be, but he was finagling and twisting and trying to bring the seminary in line with other seminaries. And so Dr. Stevenson stood up on the floor of the assembly there and argued against their confirming Dr. Machen as professor of apologetics.
and Dr. Machen, Dr. Stevenson, Dr. Alice stood up to try to defend Dr. Machen and say they should confirm. And Dr. Stevenson said, well, he said they, one of the directors, one of the most conservative of the directors, said that they had to work till late at night on Dr. Machen. And Dr. Allen says, yes, they had to work hours to persuade him to accept the position. But you see how it sounded, the way, as if he was an obstreperous sort of a fellow, hard to get along with. And they spread all kinds of rumors around. They spread the rumors that Dr. Machen's money had all come from alcohol. See, he was independently well off. And that was the rumor that was spread all over about Machen. Because the liberals would not stop at anything in order to hurt Dr. Machen. And they spread that rumor. And Dr. Machen did not defend himself on that at all. He didn't think that had anything to do with the argument. But he said to me once later on, he said, I would hate to think that a cent of my money came from alcohol. So it was just a lie, you see, that they were spreading about him. And Dr. Stevenson just tore into him there. Mrs. Robert Dick Wilson was in the gallery, and she told me when they were attacking Dr. Machen, there was an elderly gentleman there. He said under his breath, serves Machen right, serves Machen right. Look at the way he attacked dear Dr. Erdman. She says, but Mr. So-and-so, didn't Dr. Erdman attack Dr. Machen first? Oh, he says, we must forgive Dr. Erdman for that mistake that he made. But that just shows how the feeling was there. Well, in the end of it, they said that we will defer decision on the election of Dr. Machen for 1 year, which of course meant they killed the thing. Well, then I was at the assembly there, and I saw what was happening. I heard Dr. Stevenson talking and all this. And 3 days later, I was in Princeton, and I met Dr. Stevenson. And Dr. Stevenson said to me, you know, I think we did pretty well to keep Machen's election from being turned down, he said. Have it merely postponed a year, he said. He says, some of those people, on account of liquor, they just wanted to throw it out altogether. And here he'd been fighting so for that. Well, I was foolish enough to tell Dr. Machen he had said that. Dr. Machen was pretty upset about it. But before that happened, after I went back to Princeton, I went and saw Dr. Machen. And Dr. Machen, if you saw a convicted criminal who was in the prison, he could not be more dejected than Dr. Machen was after the way they had treated him at the assembly. And he acted as if he was so grateful to me for coming to see him, so. You know, you could just see how down in the dumps he was on the way that they had treated him there. But he said to me, he said, I'm going to keep on with the New Testament. He said, I'm not going to work any further along this line. And he did.
How did all of this relate to the assembly appointing the committee of three ministers and two elders to make a sympathetic study of the conditions affecting the welfare of the seminary? And actually, officially, they put the election of all professors on hold until that committee reported. What was the sentiment about this strife at the seminary?
Well, you see, the strife was caused by Dr. Stevenson, but he wasn't the sole cause of it. The big part of the cause was this pressure from elsewhere in the church to bring Princeton in line with the other seminaries that were under control of the liberals. And it was that pressure. And then there was the other pressure that most of the fine Presbyterian colleges had become liberal. And the students graduating from them were coming to the seminary.
And they were naturally didn't like this strong conservative attitude. So it was these things that made it seem like strife. And then, of course, Dr. Erdman had objected strongly to students wanting to form a League of Evangelical Students and unite with other conservative students from other schools, other colleges. And Stevenson objected to that, and Erdman objected to his name being on the letter the student sent out, though he wouldn't say he objected to anything in the letter. And we discussed that, I think, a couple of times back.
The committee that visited Princeton, though, in the end, they did find there's some statements in their reports and so on that seem to find Dr. Machen somewhat uncooperative.
He was always uncooperative with the liberals. He always was. Just as I was.
But, for example, I don't know if I can find the quotations they make, that he basically said that some of the opinions he felt were just his own, and that he wasn't speaking for the whole church. I'll have to look through this committee report to see what it was.
I've got to stop and rest a few minutes. And if you could look that through while...
One of the things that I found here, I couldn't find the exact quote of Dr. Machen, but one of the things was that his side of the issue felt that peace at the seminary was neither desirable nor possible.
Who would have said that?
Conservatives on the board of directors and in the faculty and so on.
Yes. Well, it wasn't possible as long as Stephen was president, certainly.
But do you think that was interpreted as by the committee as obstreperousness?
Well, the committee was convinced.
The
committee was convinced that they wanted Princeton and the other seminaries to be the same. And Princeton was standing for the Bible and for Christianity, and the other seminaries were standing for social works and progress and so on, and a little bit of religious fluff over it. And naturally, it's pretty hard for them to work together. But I would say that if it comes to lack of peace, Scripture says, how can two walk together except they be agreed?
What was Dr. Machen like? Just your personal knowledge.
All right. I would say that Dr. Machen was a very fine gentleman, a man of fine Christian upbringing, a man who loved the Lord and felt very deeply the gospel as being the most important thing in his life. And his desire was to make his life count for Christ in every way possible. And he was a very able man and a tremendously busy man. And a busy man is sometimes rather brusque, but I think Machen was less so than most busy people I've known. But most any busy person is going to be brusque occasionally. And there were men who were just determined to do everything they could to hurt Dr. Machen. And if they would hear him, because he was a big force against what they wanted. And so any little thing that he said or did that they would think they could spread against him, they were ready to grab. And of course, that activity, that anti-propaganda against those who wanted to stand for the gospel, was very widespread in the denomination at that time, among the leadership, not among the rank and file of the people as yet.
Well, Dr. McCrae, do you think that the majority of the rank and file were just ignorant of what was really going on?
Oh, yes, completely. Yes, I think so. There was a man who became president of McCormick Seminary about this time that I heard about, how he had, when he went to McCormick, he had been at a church for, I guess, 10 years. And in his closing message to the church, he said something like this. He said, if I had preached to you when I first came, like I've been preaching this past year, you would have thrown me out at once. But he said, you have gradually been won to what I think is the truth, and now you rejoice in it. So he had taken an orthodox fundamental Christian church and turned it into one that didn't want a fundamentalist minister. And he boasted of it. And Dr. Machen was hated by those who were trying to destroy Christianity in the Presbyterian Church in the USA because of his influence and his stand for the truth. And they were ready to spread anything they could that they thought would hurt him. Like this story, they whispered all over that his money came from breweries, from the making of. Now, it is true that Machen was a strong conservative, not only in religious things. He was a conservative on many other things. But he was never, what I'd say, unpleasantly. He was just a fine gentleman, what he was. But he was greatly misrepresented.
Do you think that rumors like that started because it said that he drank and smoked and things?
Well, he didn't. He never drank or smoked.
Why then was there the battle over Christian liberties? They were just getting 10 years ahead now, but many of the Westminster people would say there was drinking and smoking at his with the students and so on at his lodging and such. I mean, I've heard people tell me that at Westminster who lived through those days.
Not about Machen, never. But Machen was, he was very strong for the gospel, but he was not in favor of laying down a definite list of you're to do, don't, all that. He was interested in your personal relation to Christ and in your desire to do everything the way Christ wanted you to. He was not legalistic, you see, at all.
So he was comfortable with what basically became the Orthodox Presbyterian position.
Oh, yes. He never smoked, but he would buy cigars for the members of the Five Day Westminster.
I see.
Yes.
There's a contradiction in that.
The faculty that smoked, he bought the cigars?
He bought the cigars.
But this is much later. I don't understand.
This is much later. You're jumping 10 years later now.
What I wanted to ask, though, about this committee, why with members of the conservative board of directors on it and so on, William McEwen, Speer, Craig?
Well, now, Speer, I told you about my meeting with Speer, didn't I?
Yes, he was on the committee. Samuel Craig.
Well, Speer was the man who everybody said, as long as the Board of Foreign Missions is in the hands of Robert Speer, I don't care what you say, I have perfect confidence in. But Speer was a graduate of Princeton Seminary. He was a member of the Board of Directors of Princeton Seminary. And he was the head of the Board of Foreign Missions of the Presbyterian Church. Union Seminary had thrown off all allegiance to the church, although their men were coming back trying to twist the church in their direction. But Speer would not say that he was for Princeton as against Union.
So that, I mean, that's what you could expect of him on the committee then.
Why did Reverend Ethelbert D. Warfield withdraw his minority report of the General Assembly Special Committee on the Seminary? I can't understand
Ethelbert
Warfield. You know, he issued a minority report.
Now, what year was this?
This would have been 1929 General Assembly.
Oh, see, I wasn't there then. I was in Europe at that time. But I met Ethelbert Warfield. He was president of a girls' college in southern Pennsylvania.
Wilson. Oh, yeah.
He had been president of Lafayette, but the modernists got control of Lafayette and he was dropped from its presidency. And then Wilson called him as president. So I met him 40 times. He's a very fine gentleman. But I know nothing about what he did in 29.
Well, yeah, one wonders why, if the liberals had kicked him out of Lafayette and so on, why he took such a...
Maybe they'd scared him.
He did submit a minority report, although the minority report was not really...
Well, I never saw it. I never read it.
Yeah, I thought that I had read it here or seen it, but then he withdrew it. I was wondering why he withdrew it.
If you'd like a little more about Dr. Machen, Dr. Machen was not only regarded as a very great scholar, he was a first-class teacher. In his advanced courses, he was very dignified, very extremely clear, and always very interesting. In his elementary courses, he enlivened the course. I never had his elementary course, but I heard others talk about it a great deal. How he would enliven the course with lots of little comic things like throwing chalk up in the air, standing up on the chair, and different things, you know, they kind of make it easy and interesting for them. Even the fellows that utterly disagreed with him were very enthused about his elementary courses. And he had many interests. He was a great mountain climber. He loved climbing mountains. He used to go over in the Alps a great deal. I did some climbing with him in the Canadian Rockies the last year before his death. And, he was just, he was a wonderfully clear writer. There was an organization that published a book on 9 sermons of the year. They got different people. The others were all pastors of big churches. But they got a sermon from Dr. Machen, who was professor in the seminary. That is, he was assistant professor. He was excellent in just about everything he undertook.
And
his book on beginning Greek was immediately or very soon adopted by Harvard and Yale as their standard for beginning Greek, and to this day, as far as I know, they still do.
He didn't mind teaching beginning Greek. Did he always do teach that? I mean, here at Biblical, nobody wants to teach that. So Wayne Davidson teaches it, and Sherry Call teaches it, and so on. Was there no sense that Dr. Machen, after being there for 20 or over 20 years, I guess, had any or about that?
I don't know when he came. He graduated from seminary in 1906, and then he went over to Germany and studied for a time. And then he came back, and I would imagine he started teaching.
Early teens. I've seen the date. I forget it. But he had been there for years.
Yeah. And he used to have what they called the checker club. They would just announce in the different eating clubs. They'd say, checker club meets tonight. And that would mean that Dr. Machen's room in the dormitory was, everybody was invited to drop in and play checkers or chess, or different games. He had a lot of games there, and he'd have apples and oranges and candy and all kinds of things for everybody to take it. You never knew. Maybe 3 or 4 times a semester you would have the checker club at his room. I think everybody liked him except the people who hated the gospel and consequently hated him because he stood for the gospel.
So he didn't mind continuing the beginning courses and teaching of those. So he taught. What courses did you have him for?
Unfortunately, I had had Greek in college, and then I had 2 years with no Greek. And I wish they had required me to take the what they call Greek C with them, because I think my Greek would have been much more solid if I had.
Do they have a placement exam?
They have a placement exam, and they excuse me from any elementary Greek at all. And I had sufficient Greek for the courses, but I think I would have profited all my life but to having further grounding in it, particularly if I could have had under him.
So then you had what, the New Testament exegetical book courses? Or?
Yes, his course in Galatians was his big course. That was the main one, I think, that I had with him. I forget what else I had. I think I had a New Testament, the one that dealt with manuscripts.
Background?
Text.
Introduction.
New Testament introduction. Okay. That'd be it. I had that from him. He was very strict.
And you say you also had a course from Dr. Stevenson.
No. I don't think I ever had a course from him. Oh, maybe I did. Because it would be the course in how to preach. Yes, the course in homiletics. I believe Dr. Stevenson had it because I remember some of the good stories he told. And I remember that he would often have visiting speakers. And those visiting speakers made you wonder how much real idea of the gospel he had to have them. For instance, one was a Presbyterian missionary from India. And he was president of a Presbyterian college in India. And he mentioned in his class one day that about half of their teachers were Brahmins or Buddhists or other religions. And Dr. Stonehouse, who was a classmate of mine, wasn't a doctor yet then, he asked, well, if it's a Christian college, why do you have non-Christian teachers? And he said, some of our non-Christians are our best Christians.
Oh,
and, of course, it's obvious that what he meant was that some of these folks that had no knowledge of Christianity had wonderful character. But that's not Christianity. Christianity will produce character such as no other religion will. But Christianity isn't character. It's that which produces character.
Right.
And they were having their students taught by people that didn't have that. And there were different things like that. And I heard toward the end of my time there, I heard members of the faculty say, they said, we spend all our time trying to impress the great facts of Christianity. And then when we have day of prayer or commencement or any of these days, Dr. Stevenson brings in speakers that deny everything we say. That's the way that...
Now, has that been going on for years and years?
I suppose, I don't know, I wasn't there. But I would guess it was. Dr. Stevenson knew the lingo. He could give a marvelous Christian message. But his heart wasn't in it, you see. He was ecumenical, is the word that describes it. He wasn't anti-Christian, he was just ecumenical.
Would you say he was a Christian, based on your...
I would not judge anyone.
Really?
No. When I was ordained, one of the Presbytery of Los Angeles, they asked me, was the Constantine's conversion general? And I said, I cannot judge the genuineness of anyone's faith.
But Stevenson,
that's
would,
between them and the Lord.
He would consider himself,
oh,
claim to be a real Christian.
He would claim to be. When he, this man who had come there particularly for the strong Christian teaching at the seminary, he happened to go to a general meeting. I guess you'd call it like a Bible, I don't know, you know, like a convention meeting where they had Dr. Stevenson speak. Oh, he says, Dr. Stevenson rang every bell.
he came out on all the Christians. He would subscribe to any Christian view you wanted him to. I mean, and so would Dr. Erdman. They threw right down the line, but they were just perfectly ready to work with those who were denying everything they claimed to teach. And they're the most dangerous. Not the people that are out and out, and you can see what they are, but the people that say one thing and do another.
Do you have any idea why that happened? What do you think caused that?
I think it was the atmosphere in the whole educated world. It came. It started in Harvard back by 1700. They were already destroying faith in students. And it spread through our colleges and through the seminaries. And, of course, this is true, too, that everybody has times when the ethics of the Christian stand become a little bit difficult for you. And at such times, there's a great temptation to let down your doctrine. And over the course of years, it has. And then I think one of the big causes is people who have spent an awful lot of time arguing over minor points, many of which you can't prove. This is somebody's guess from the scripture, and somebody else's guess may be just as good. You get big arguments over minor points, and you neglect the major. I've known people who could recognize an Arminian two blocks away and would walk right up to a modernist and see nothing wrong with it. I think when you emphasize the minors, you're apt to neglect the majors when you're over it.
You mentioned that you didn't have any courses with Dr. Green.
No, I know.
What was Dr. Green like? Did he want Dr. Machen to succeed him? And what sort of reputation did he have? Did you know? Did you meet him? Did your paths cross?
I had no contact with him. I used to see him around. He was very old, and some of the students who took his course in Christian ethics, they said he was very gracious and very nice, and he would say everybody has contributed something to the discussion. Very pleasant fellow. Now, how deep his scholarship was. It may have been very excellent for all I know, but I just don't know. I never took a course with him. But he was very old, and I never did hear whether he died, whether he retired, or whatever. I just had no contact with him.
Yeah, I believe he passed away in the next few years there. There's a historical note here somewhere in the PCUSA minutes about his passing.
Oh, there is. Well, could you look that up and tell us next time?
I'll try to note that, too. And have we covered Robert Dick Wilson thoroughly?
No, we haven't covered Machen thoroughly. Wilson was very different from Machen. I would say Machen had a grace about himself that's quite rare. Wilson was a nice fellow, a very nice fellow, and very pleasant, very interesting, but didn't have that charm about him, which Erdman had to a superlative degree, and which Machen had, not like Erdman, but yet very definitely, more than most. Wilson was, of course, a very great scholar, a very great student, and he felt very keenly on the Bible, and he was very much against making a lot of minor things. Now, for instance, I think the Bible clearly teaches premillennialism. I don't think that should be made a point of division of Christian fellowship, but I think we lose something important if we don't have the great hope that the premillennial teaching gives us. I heard Dr. Wilson say, I'm not a premillennialist, I'm not an amillennialist, I'm not a postmillennialist, I'm a millennialist. Well, I don't think that was a good way to express it, but I know what he meant. He meant his emphasis was on the big Christian issues, the fundamental things that make a difference with our eternal life, rather than on our difference about secondary matters, even though they might be quite important.
Was his pedagogy quite good? lot better, hopefully, than Dr. Voss's, for example, or C.W. Hodges.
As a pedagogue, I'd say Wilson is about the same as Hodge or Voss, yes. He was not a great teacher by any means.
Was there any concern? I've heard this, I've read this, maybe it was in Letcher's book, that Princeton, and you see this struggle
yes.
right at Biblical today,
yes.
with, between the exegetical and the practical, or the scholarly
yes.
and the
yes.
and the practical, ministering to people.
Well, that, did you ever hear of Sherwood Eddy?
Yes.
He was a great speaker on Christian themes all over the world. But Christian, Sherwood Eddy said to a friend of mine, he said, if you go to Princeton, you'll come out with a thorough knowledge of the Bible and a thorough knowledge of great things of Christianity. But he says, what you would get at Union, it'll take you 10 years to make up. He says, if you go to Union, you'll come out as a polished scholar and an able speaker. But he says the knowledge of the Bible that the Princeton man will have, it'll take you 10 years to catch up. Well, that showed that Eddie had no understanding of the conflict, but he saw the difference.
Was something of that difference a reason for some people's concern about Princeton? In other words, did some people feel that the pedagogy should be more practically oriented? Maybe Dr. Erdman embodied some of that. Maybe some
yes.
of it was,
Erdman was a very gracious, pleasant gentleman, but you never had an idea that his heart was very deeply in it. He wrote nice little books about the New Testament books, and he was a very pleasant, charming person, so long as you didn't step on his toes in any way.
Was there a feeling that Princeton produced people that would go into the church and make good pastors, or that more than it produced scholars? In other words, this idea, like we have today, well, this guy knows Hebrew and Greek and can do this and that, but he goes into a church and in 2 years he's left. There's some kind of a practical theology problem there. Was there any of that dimension?
Well,
or concern or whatever?
I think perhaps there was a lack there. I think that could have been greatly benefited. A great deal of improvement could have been made in that regard.
Were there any student evaluations of the nope. different courses?
Nothing like that. That's quite a modern thing. Yeah, we began that at Faith. I'd never heard of it at Westminster or at Church.
I think we've talked about Dr. Armstrong and Dr. Did you have Dr. Erdman for any classes?
Oh, yes.
What were his classes like?
Very sweet, very pleasant, very superficial.
How about Frederick, Dr. Letcher? I guess you mentioned that you did have a class in church history from...
Well, I had him 3 years solid, once a week.
Okay.
For 3 years, yeah. He was
just
straight lecturing. Dr. Letcher could take the most interesting thing and make it tiresome.
And Dr. Alice, did you have Dr. Alice?
Oh, yes. Dr. Ellis was Dr. Ellis would teach the step in Dr. Wilson, from Dr. Wilson's book, he would teach this fact, this matter, and then he would repeat it again, and then he'd go through it again,
Now, didn't the brighter students get frustrated with that?
Sure did. I'm tired of the death of that. But then they'd go into Dr. Wilson, who would dash through things in a hurry and take for granted you'd learn them yourselves. And there was one fellow I remember purposely stayed with Dr. Ellis when he could have gone into Dr. Wilson's fire session because he thought he got a solider grip on the basics. Who had been a newspaper man,
And he came to seminary on account of the modernist fundamentalist discussion. He came to seminary because he wanted to get the facts and he wanted to learn the evidences of Christianity. He was he's from the back country of Maryland, something of a country who he got on the street like this, like he just has. And kind of he had a big knowledge and a very nice fellow. Well, now at Princeton, when I was there, they didn't make you take Hebrew your first year. I introduced that faith. It had to be taken the first year. But at Princeton, unless you're on a four-year schedule, but at Princeton, they would you could take it the second year. You were required to take 1 year of Hebrew, 4 hours a week, and then the second year, you had one course for 2 hours in the first semester. That was the course in the Book of Ruth. These were both from Dr. Alice, unless you were one of the better students who had Dr. Wilson. Well, my senior year at seminary, Dr. Alice came to me just a very few days before commencement. And Dr. Alice says, now here's Minor Simpson. He's just a grand poet, he says. And he stands for the truth right down the line. But he says he's failed his beginning Hebrew. And he says, could you give him some tutoring? And I said, yes, I'd be glad to. Well, Dr. Minor Simpson had taken beginning Hebrew from Dr. Ellis. It was a full year course, and he had flunked. But they had let him take, oh yes, he could take it over, but he could take the second year course at the same time. He took the second year course and he passed it. But he failed the beginning course again. So Dr. Ellis said, would you help him I'll give him a special exam on Monday morning before commencement if you'll tutor him. Well, Dr. Minor said to me, he says, I never study on Sunday. So I worked with him Saturday right up till midnight. At the midnight we stopped, and then he came to my room at midnight Sunday night when it was Monday morning and we worked Monday morning. And I worked with him for hours and hours and hours and worked with him. Dr. Ellis was so anxious that Minor Simpson, with whom he agreed so thoroughly, you know, and the stand he took and everything, that he should pass. So Minor worked with me Monday morning up until 8:30, and then he went and got some breakfast and took the exam at 9. And Dr. Machen came over, and he commenced with us to be Tuesday. And he came over and he says, Doc, he says, Minor's past his beginning Hebrew, he says. Well, I said, that's great. I says, now he can graduate. Oh, yes, he says, I hope so. But he says, he couldn't really pass second year Hebrew before he passed first Hebrew. That would be illogical. So he says, we can't count his exam in the Book of Ruth last week. He'll have to take that over. But he says, I'll let him take that over tomorrow morning before commencement. Well, he was so tired that when he took the Book of Ruth over, he failed it. So he had to come back another year. So you see, Dr. Alice was right down the line on the letter of the law. And Dr. Alice said to me one day at Westminster, he says, Dr. Wilson has an awful lot to answer for. He says he wrote the hardest book on beginning Hebrew that ever was written. Oh, he says, terrible hard book. And he says, those students have gone through that book and pondered over it. And he says, and Dr. Alice for 16 years had taught Dr. Wilson's book step by step, letter by letter, line by line. And Dr. Alice says, Dr. Wilson has an awful lot to answer for writing a book like that. Well, I was in Germany when they wanted me to speak to teach at Westminster, and hadn't gotten my mail for a month because I'd been in the mountains. So when I got it, I wired them and said, I'm sorry, their school was just going to start. I said, I'm sorry, I just got word and I got an answer from Dr. Wilson teaching your classes till you arrive. Well, I got there, and Dr. Wilson had started right in giving them the most advanced stuff, and after 2 weeks, they were writing ionian verbs with suffixes on the board, and they didn't know anything about Hebrew. And I said to Dr. Wilson, I said, Dr. Alice for 16 years has taught this step by step. And I said, you've taught it the exact opposite way. Now I said, what way shall I teach it? He says, teach it any way you want. So I combined the two. I taught the important things, and I made them pick up the secondary things, and they learned it twice as fast as with either of the others. And fortunately, I had a whole year to do that with Dr. Wilson as head of the department, see? And then the next year, after the second week, Dr. Wilson died. And I went right on teaching the way I had, and Dr. Alice kind of questioned me about it, and I kind of sidestepped his question. So he told somebody, he said, Mr. McCray, can keep quiet in several modern and ancient languages. But I was fortunate that I had it from Dr. Wilson a year, you see, because Dr. Wilson says any way you want, and I think that would have been his attitude toward Dr. Alice. But Dr. Alice was right down the line, see, and he couldn't pass him in second year because he took the exam before he passed the first year exam, you see.
Unbelievable.
But he was an awfully nice fellow, Dr. Alice was, and he stood for the truth very strong.
I should introduce the date in that. Hello, it is now Thursday, July 13th, and we are interviewing Dr. Alan McCray in room 28 at Biblical Seminary. It's about 5:40 p.m. Stephen Haig, Dr. McCray, my son Kent Pakula, and I. And Dr. McCray, last time we were talking about Dr. Green's death. We noted since then that he passed away November 16, 1928, and apparently was not active, since he was not active after your first year, which was 24 to 25. And then we were talking about the moderator that succeeded Dr. Erdman of the General Assembly, William O. Thompson, and you were beginning to tell us about Dr. Erdman's remarks regarding Dr. Thompson at the time of his election.
What's the date, time of that? What year?
Thompson was the moderator in 26 to 27. His term would have finished up in 27.
Yep.
And during that year, 26 to 27, he served as the chairman of this committee of five to visit Princeton Seminary. The moderator was to appoint the other members. They were Reverend George M. Luckock of Worcester, Ohio, Reverend Walter Whalen of Newark, New Jersey, and then two ruling elders, both of them judges apparently, Thomas Bradley of Chicago and Richard Ernst of Covington, Kentucky.
Yeah, I remember when Dr. Thompson was elected to moderator. He succeeded Dr. Erdman, did you say, as moderator?
I believe so. I can double-check that here. Succeeded Dr. Erdman.
Yes, that was in 26.
Yes, Dr. Erdman retired in 26.
Yes, and
from the moderatorship.
I remember Dr. Erdman telling a story there at a meeting that fall. He said that as moderator, he traveled over the country extensively. And he said that the man who was the secretary of the committee on, was it national missions or was one of those leading secretaries in the permanent organization, you know. He said the two of them would go to an area, and they would each speak in many places, several places in the area, and then they'd come together in one place with representatives from all of these places, and there they would both speak. And he said that this other man, I can't think of what the name was, a very fine speaker he was, he said that he noticed that each time they did this, that he gave the same message. So he said after he'd heard it several times, he knew it by heart. So he said the next place they went to like that, he said that he got up and he gave the other fellow's message, he said. And he gave it all word for word, just as the other man had given all these places. And then he said this other fellow got up and he said didn't appear the least bit flustered and gave an entirely different message. And he was admiring the other fellow's presence of mind. But at the end of the meeting, the other fellow said to him, he said, just 3 weeks ago, I was in this same church and gave that message that you gave tonight.
So he was prepared to give a different one for a change.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah. Well, that's a story, of course, but it was... maybe Erdman made it up. Maybe it really happened. I don't know. But Erdman was a very polished gentleman. He gave you that impression. He used to tell about somebody being converted by a sunset. And that's very, like, fantastic, sort of thing. And when he retired from the moderatorship, he introduced Thompson.
From Columbus, Ohio, I see.
Yes, and he said that the church was making progress in, what was it, peace? What are the three things you swear to support? The
purity and unity?
Wrecks the story.
Yeah.
Anyway, he in introducing him, he told how they were making progress, and he says this man had come from the United Presbyterian Church originally, showed they were making progress in purity or something like that. But that's, it was very interesting at the time, but it kind of ruined, it fails in retelling, especially when I don't remember it particularly accurately.
Well, you remember a lot of it very well. Do you happen to...
A lot of it comes back, you know.
Sure. Do you happen...
Gradually comes back.
Do you happen to know Bradley... Whalen,
no.
Any of these other members of the committee, Lukoch, or Lukoch?
I'm quite sure Lukoch was a liberal.
What was Thompson? Was he, the other one was Ernst,
Thompson
Richard Ernst.
Thompson had been president of Ohio State University. Now that comes back to me. I think he was retired from that.
I see. And this committee came and visited, and their feeling was that the contention at Princeton must end. And they made statements like petty personalities should cease, there must be a defining of rights and responsibilities, and then adhering to prerogatives. They said the alumni present felt this all was essential. The alumni indicated their belief that the difficulties within Princeton not only should be, but also could be overcome. But then they went on to say that Dr. Machen tried to secure the cancellation of John Davis's appointment as a temporary instructor in theology during the illness of Dr. C.W. Hodge. Have we discussed that at all? He felt that he declined to join in a request that Dr. Davis should accept the appointment. As a result, there was agitation on the campus which brought Dr. Davis under suspicion. The current rumor went so far as to intimate that Dr. Machen had warned the students against accepting the teachings of Dr. Davis. A further source of division was found in the opposition to the candidacy of Dr. Erdman for the office of moderator of the General Assembly. And the committee felt that these activities may have been within the right of individual members, but the faculty courtesy or etiquette would seem to require more discretion. Their report seems somewhat, kind of condescending. For example, statements like, it is to be regretted that matters of this sort continue in the minds of men dealing with much larger issues, kind of shame, shame sort of tone to some of the report. But one of the things they really seemed bothered by was, for example, illustrated by, unfortunately, they say, in this connection, it was said that Dr. Machen in a subsequent declaration stated that his ground for opposition to two eminent Presbyterian pastors and the general secretary of one of our boards, whom the faculty committee had recommended as seminary preachers, was that these men, quote, are not Christians. And that seems to have, you know, upset the committee. And they felt also that the president of Princeton occupies a, quote, impossible position. Meaning that it's unclear what his prerogatives really are, and that this goes back to the custom of having a chairman of the faculty rather than a president in an administrative capacity. The statement, though, that we were referring to before about that Dr. Machen made was... They mention Christianity and liberalism, and they say, they quote, for example, page 171, of every dollar contributed to the Board of Foreign Missions, perhaps half goes to the support of true missionaries of the cross, while the other half goes to the support of those who are persuading men that the message of the cross is unnecessary or wrong. This statement, the committee said, seems an indictment of the General Assembly electing the members of all our boards. It is not meant that Professor Machen intended it to be so, but the statement was so disturbing that he was asked for some support. His reply was that, quote, my books are matters of my opinion. However, upon request, he added that his view was that the church was facing very grave issues and that the boards and agencies were not representative of the church as a whole. The committee, again, recognizes the right to, you know, question the policies and so on, but they said that the defense is inadequate when it is stated that these statements are matters of opinion. They all have the effect of being statements of fact. Attention was drawn to the gravity of making such statements in public books without supporting evidence. The proper procedure, which the assembly would no doubt welcome, would be a complaint through proper channels as to the qualifications of members elected by the assembly to membership on the board. How much of this had any effect with Dr. Machen, and how much do you think that he and others felt was using church?
When was this report?
This report was the one in 1927 from the Committee of Five, Thompson and Luckoff and so on.
San Francisco.
Right. And they visited the seminary, I think, the preceding fall and so on. Then they made this report, and this was before the larger Committee of 11, you know, but this was when you would have still, I guess it would have been your senior year.
This was after my senior year.
Okay.
Yes, this was the summer after my senior year.
But they would have visited during your senior year.
Yes.
Right.
I don't have a very clear recollection of their visit, but their report there is just like the reports that were being turned in all the time at that time. Of course, to say anybody isn't a Christian is to them just like saying he's a villain or something. Or he isn't a nice gentleman.
Yeah,
but as Dr. Machen points out so clearly in his book, Christianity and Liberalism, liberalism isn't not only not Christianity, it belongs to an entirely different group of religions. It's not even a similar type of religion. And Machen made that very clear in his book. And when I was up at Princeton not so long ago, someone told me there that they had gone to the Princeton Seminary library bookstore and had bought a
copy of Bacon's Christianity and Liberalism, and that the student who was a clerk in the store said to them that this is a very dangerous book. He said, it is so clearly written and so very impressive in the way it presents things that he said, it's apt to lead people astray. He said, it's very dangerous. But evidently he thought that they did good to free their students from the danger of it by having them read it and then discuss it in class and point out its error. Of course, its error would be to say that anybody wasn't a Christian, and of course, a Christian is just a nice gentleman, and we all are. But it was utterly ridiculous that Union Seminary, which had been thrown out or had been under attack in the 1890s for its modernism and had thrown off all control of the assembly, its people were voting in the assembly there to examine person which was standing for the Christian faith. And they were persecuting the ones who were standing for the historic Christian faith. And all this folderol about people not being gentlemanly and all that, well, there was, you get those modernists together and you hear some of the most awful talk about Christians. There was a group of students there, the seminary, who had graduated from Presbyterian colleges, which colleges within the previous 20 years the modernists had gotten control of, and these students were pretty well brainwashed in that direction. And when they were going to have a man who was a strong defender of the historic position of the seminary speaking in the seminary chapel on Sunday, they would say something derogatory to keep students from attending. And we heard that the pastor of, I think it was the Second Presbyterian Church of Pittsburgh, who was one of the leaders against the modernists, he was to speak in chapel, they announced, the next week. And these fellows all whispered, you better sit up front if you go or you'll be able to hear him. And with the idea, of course, it would persuade people that they better go to the First or Second Presbyterian Church instead of the seminary chapel where they'd hear this man. And I went and sat up in front so I could be sure to hear him, and he had a big booming voice. It was purely out of whole cloth in order to persuade people not to hear it. And that's the type of, the modernists will descend to any kind of trickery in order to hurt the gospel. And I observed it there very clearly. And that was going on in all the seminaries, of course, but except that the other seminaries had just been quietly taken over. The person was the last one left. Of all the old seminaries in most of the denominations, they had just quietly seen that. And incidentally, I think that it's interesting to note that tenure of professors began, I believe, when people in Christian institutions sworn to uphold the gospel and the Bible in their classes were being convinced that the Bible was a lot of fables and legends, and they said, we are making progress in our research, and our opinion should not be, people shouldn't object to our opinions, and you should give us security in our position. So that whole idea of tenure was established that way. And, of course, it enabled the modernists to get control of institutions much more easily than they could have without that. Now, in recent years, the educational authorities are seeing the difficulties. In place after place, people have completely changed against what they believed when they came in, and they have tenure. And without making a big fuss, you can't get rid of them. And other people get lazy, and they have tenure, and they go ahead, and it's just a waste of the students' time. I feel that it's one of the most harmful things in American education, this development of this idea of tenure. But, of course, on the other hand, people shouldn't be subject to being dropped just any time, but at least once in 5 years,
it should be possible to get rid of a professor without having to assign a reason for it. You can find the sufficient evidence without necessarily finding evidence that you stand up in a court of law.
Well, I know you've been opposed to tenure here at Biblical, and it's interesting to hear that background. I think I'm more sympathetic to it, hearing that background. And you might, what you say also is somewhat confirmed by an Edward Dowie, who's currently a professor at Princeton Seminary, I understand.
Well, isn't he the one who wrote the new confession that replaced the Westminster Confession?
I think, he did work on that, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe he was at one time to be on Dr. Peterson's dissertation committee, and then something came up. I'm not sure that he served on that. I forget the details. But I did hear from a Presbyterian pastor, I think it was in Titusville, New Jersey, that Dr. Dowie felt that Concordia Seminary would be the last of the old seminary strongholds to fall from the fundamentalist camp, so to speak. And, of course, he was wrong.
Well,
in the end. But that was his vision of that. It kind of went along from a liberal side to with your conservative view is of that.
Concordia came within an ace of being taken over by the modernists. Practically the whole faculty left when the evangelicals retained control.
But it's interesting from his perspective. Yeah. And yet also I've heard him referred to as one of the conservatives at Princeton Seminary. Well, so I guess he is somewhat conservative in certain areas.
He probably still believes in looking at the Bible occasionally.
But I thought that was interesting. That is secondhand at best, but it kind of goes along with that view of these seminaries moving from the position that Princeton had. He certainly felt that. Also, in a Union Seminary bulletin within the last year or two, they had, I think it was President Gillespie of Princeton, the new president, was up there for an occasion. And this tension between Princeton and Union in the late 19th and early 20th century was mentioned. And there was kind of a remark made that they are now in the same, see things the same way, which kind of goes along with the same thing. Also, there's a professor, I'm not sure if it was Hinson or which church history or other professor it was from Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, who in Louisville Seminary, Southern Seminary in Louisville, has a periodical called The Tie for their alumni and so on, which we get here in the library. And they had a professor speaking at Union Seminary. I guess his speech there at Union was mentioned in the Union Seminary publication. But he made the struggle within the Southern Baptist Convention today analogous, if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to recall this, to the struggle of Dr. Driver in the 1890s at Union Seminary, which again is... shows that from a moderate or liberal standpoint, there's a similarity in the perception of some. Not that it can't be easily oversimplified, and there aren't lots of nuances. But
it's the same thing that's happened in denomination after denomination. Seminary after seminary, college after college. Satan is very clever. Disguised as an angel of light.
Did Dr. Mason, though, have any comeback to these kind of polity-based arguments that he was being going overboard and saying things like they aren't Christians?
That was the whole point of his book, Christianity and Liberalism.
But was that too heavy medicine? Was he ahead of his time? Was that too much for some people to understand?
Not if they read the book. But if people already thought of a Christian as like an American, because it's a nice gentleman, that's all it is, they'd already been carried to the point where there was no doctrinal content, whatever the word, Why, that is like saying a man's not an American.
But how did Dr. Stevenson and Dr. Erdman apparently very vehemently protested that they were not guilty of doctrinal indifferentism, which they're charged with by the conservatives on the faculty, or at least that was a charge that is mentioned here in this report. They felt, I don't think they were lying. I think they were convinced that they weren't guilty of doctrinal indifferentism. But how did
These modernists, they convince people that they're right, and they gradually lead you over. People, it's like being in a place with germs. They affect you. You say, my faith is strong enough to stand. A person who submits himself to studying where you have to assume unchristian principles as a foundation on which to work out your theory. When he submits himself steadily to that sort of thing, it's pretty hard to step back and cast aside what have been presuppositions. It's not the direct argument, but it's the argument based upon presuppositions. And you swallow those presuppositions. And you're led over into that without your even realizing.
Well, that is certainly rich material, Dr. McCray, and I appreciate your taking more time with that. And as I went over the report of the larger committee, which then visited and made it... I had a couple of questions. One was, why did they wait 1 year after, in 1928 at the assembly... You know, this Committee of Five recommended, apparently, that they there should be, they recommended in 1927 that this should be pursued far further, this whole situation at Princeton, and that kind of it was leading toward the reorganization of the seminary in what they were recommending. But this larger committee, the Committee of Five said the root and source of the serious difficulties at Princeton, they felt these had to be addressed. This situation was an embarrassment to the church. It was being written up in newspapers and magazines, and there were different charges, and they felt that the conservatives were unyielding, that they didn't want peace, they were uncooperative. And so they said that the conclusion and summary of the findings in spring of 1927 was the root and source of serious difficulties in Princeton, and the greatest obstacle to the removal of these difficulties seemed to be in the plan of government by two boards.
Yeah, that was, of course, nonsense. The trouble was that they had people of two opinions in the board, in both boards. And in one board, one group was in the majority, and the other group, the other group. The other was in the majority.
But then they recommended that the assembly appoint a committee of 11 members, of whom at least three shall be ruling elders in the Presbyterian Church and so on, moderator, and six additional members, two of whom shall be members of the Board of Trustees, two shall be members of the Board of Directors, two from the Church at large, and so on, and they're to confer with these people. And so then... During 1927 to 28, they apparently go ahead and visit the seminary, and then in 28 at Tulsa, Oklahoma, Robert Speer was the moderator in the meantime that year, 27 to 28. Then Hugh Kelso Walker from the Presbytery of Los Angeles was elected in 28 to 29. Do you know him at all? Did you know of Reverend Hugh Kelso Walker, Presbytery of Los Angeles.
No, I didn't know him at all.
He served as moderator
in
28 to 29 in that year.
Well, he wasn't very prominent in that presbytery, I don't think, in 27, because that's when I was ordained there, and I don't remember anything about him, unless he's a man some people call Weepy Water. But I may have that mixed. It might be some other man they call that, who could give a sermon in which he kind of wept over these things. People thought it was so beautiful. But whether there was any Christian teaching along with the weeping, I don't know.
Well,
I never heard it.
A year later, at the General Assembly of 1928, you were abroad by then.
Yeah. Where was that one?
That one was at Tulsa, Oklahoma. And there were these majority and minority reports of the Committee of 11 that had visited that year following your graduation, 27 to 28. They visited. And they said that the Assembly felt that if these reports were adopted or rejected, they leave the situation at the seminary unsettled, and therefore they resolved that a further consideration of the reports be postponed for 1 year, and the Board of Directors, the more conservative board, be instructed to proceed immediately to compose the differences at the seminary and make a full report on these instructions to the next assembly. And so then there was a year's wait. But there was a minority report. I don't know why. It was by a Reverend Warfield. I don't know why he withdrew it.
Oh, you mean it isn't in there?
It's in the 28 minutes, but then in the 29 minutes, when everything came to a head, it just says he withdrew the minority report.
Yes.
And his minority report said that he, with profound regret, I find myself unable to accept the statements of the case, I was on record as concurring in the statement presented to the committee appointed by the Assembly of 1926 by the President of the Board of Directors, and in an argument before that committee, I urged the continuation of the government of the seminary by two boards. Nevertheless, I am unable to concur in the conclusions of the committee. One, he said, near the conclusion of the deliberation, statement on historical background was offered by the chairman. He dissented from that statement.
Was this at the